This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Up next is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater presents a monthly film series on the second Thursday of each month. January 10th at 7 p.m., we present the 1988 film Talk Radio, in which a rude, contemptuous talk show host becomes overwhelmed by the hatred that surrounds his program just before it goes national.
Open your mouth and tell me what we're going to do about the mess this country's in. Talk radio. It's the last neighborhood in town. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Let's go to the first caller. Night Talk.
Before the film, we'll hear Carl Wolfson, who will talk about his experience as a talk show host in Portland. And the film will be introduced by a KBOO board member and Wednesday morning talk show host, Lisa Loving. That's January 10th at the Clinton Street Theater at 7 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/kboofilms.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Works, presented by the Portland Area Theater Alliance from January 24th through February 3rd. Fertile Ground features 88 events with over 50 artists and companies, including Artists Repertory Theater, Portland Playhouse, and Polaris Dance, and dozens more. For a 10-day festival pass or ticket info, visit fertilegroundpdx.org or go to kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
Portland activists gather to support the Idle No More movement for Canadian Native rights.
Trial begins Thursday for the teenager accused of plotting to blow up a tree lighting ceremony in downtown Portland.
And TriMet will implement a new policy to prevent driver exhaustion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 8th, 2013. I'm Alex Ward.
And I'm Ren Green. The Idle No More movement for Indigenous rights has galvanized Native activists throughout Canada, the U.S., and the rest of the world for the last several weeks. Organizers are preparing to stage rallies this coming Friday, which is designated as the Global Day of Action. It coincides with the same day that Prime Minister Stephen Harper plans to meet with some Native leaders, including Attawapiskat Chief Teresa Spence. Spence has been on hunger strike since December 11, 2012, and intends to continue the protest until Harper meets with the leaders of Aboriginal communities. Locally, a Native flash mob and round dance was held in Pioneer Square in Portland on Sunday to support Canadian Indigenous rights. KBOO's Paul Rowland was there and brings us the sound of the rally.
About what's happening in your own community.
Amen.
What's happening right here in our own backyard.
That's right.
This is happening everywhere. I'm from Beaver Lake Cree Nation in northern Alberta, and for the past 50 years, we've seen the Canadian government, the Alberta government, steal our land. The oil sands, the tar sands, have been going on for 50 years.
Yes.
We're fighting to stop this. We're going to court. This march,
yes.
We can stop it.
Yes.
We have set legal precedent. We can stop this.
Looks like we have a good turnout. Like he said, this isn't going to stop until we make something happen. And I think this is a good step towards making something happen. So everyone just needs to keep it up.
Adrian Jacobs, Six Nations Reserve in Southern Ontario. Our people have been dealing with government violation of our treaty since 1793. Our first land claim issues happened then. So 2006, the most recent thing, is just something in a long line of violation. Well, recently there's been a whole series of legislation that's been, one's been passed, a couple have been passed, and more are slated to be passed by the federal government. Just violating the treaty relationship that First Nations have with the Canadian state. And it's just something that sparked a grassroots movement called Idle No More, led by four ladies from Saskatchewan, the province of Saskatchewan. And It has mobilized a lot of people to say, we're tired of this, and we need to just stand up and say, no more violation. We need to stand up for our rights as a people, not just by our leaders, not by those that have been appointed leaders, but by the grassroots. That's where the power comes from anyways. There is a traditional leadership that goes back from before Columbus, and it's a government of the people. It's been the leaders have legitimacy because of the culture, but there's always been an imposed leadership, including in Canada. There's tribal governments in the U.S. and then band councils in Canada. And they're really not accountable to the people. They're accountable to the Prime Minister and to the Minister of Indian Affairs. And so this grassroots movement is saying, no, it's the people that is, that we're the ones that are important, and not just this elected leadership. And they're backing a lot of the traditional leaders, because that's where the treaties were made, with our traditional leaders. And so there's that dichotomy. But we're all of the same group, and we're all fighting, and people are trying to do different things on different levels. And I think it's brought everybody together in Canada, and really appreciate the support from the U.S. as well.
I think it's become a personal movement for a lot of people.
It's beautiful. If each individual refused to be idle no more, that would make a better collective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if we're not healthy on the inside of ourselves, we can't be healthy as a community. If we can't love ourselves, how are we supposed to love our community? How are we supposed to take care of each other if we can't take care of ourselves?
Those were the sounds of Sunday's rally in downtown Portland to support the Canadian Idle No More Indigenous Rights Movement. An International Day of Action this Friday has over 100 cities planning actions, including a flash mob at the Canadian Consulate in Portland. Activists will gather at 3 o'clock this Friday at 805 Southwest Broadway to support Idle No More's call for global action on the day Prime Minister Harper meets with the Assembly of First Nations determined representatives and Chief Teresa Spence enters 1 month of her hunger strike.
The trial of Mohammed Mohammed, the alleged 2010 Christmas tree bomber, begins tomorrow in Portland. KBOO's Don Merrill talked to Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about the trial.
What is Mr. Mohammed accused of doing exactly?
Mr. Mohammed wanted to explode a van of full of explosives near the Christmas tree lighting ceremony in November of 2010. And it's pretty clear from looking at the history of the FBI and how they bring people in, and that Mr. Mohammed was a teenager at the time, and that he probably could never have had the resources, since he lived in Corvallis, he probably wouldn't have the resources to come up to Portland and put together the explosive device, much less conduct the plot, that it would never happen if the FBI hadn't suggested it.
And I read the court documents against Mr. Mohammed, and it seemed as though he was sort of run through a decision tree. Why is the FBI employing what seems to be Islamophobic behavior? And why do they seem to be steering people to make these kinds of decisions or to encourage them to act in ways that will guarantee that these people go to prison?
To put it simply, to continue the charade of this war on terrorism, they have to produce occasionally a threat. So if they can continue to produce people, particularly who are the quote the other in our unfortunate racist society, they can say there's an ongoing problem, and your community needs to be on alert, and you need to be scared, and you need to be supporting the FBI in these efforts. And particularly, I think they chose Portland because Portland was the only city in the United States that had withdrawn its officers from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We were trying to follow a state law that says you can't investigate people's religious, social, or political affiliations unless there's a reasonable suspicion that there's criminal activity.
Are you saying that the FBI is trying to punish Portland or in
no,
some...
No, I think the FBI was trying to draw Portland back into the terrorism task force, which they succeeded at doing. And we're supposed to get a report from the police chief every January about how often that's been happening. Last year, he refused to give a list of how many times it had been done, presumably because it hadn't been done very many times. One of the things that is already of concern is that the FBI informants that tricked Mr. Muhammad into thinking that he was going to be blowing up this van are going to be appearing by closed-circuit TV with their faces blurred out. But it just adds to the layers of mistrust that what happened was in any way legitimate to not be able to see or even identify who these people are.
So the work that you do, mostly focusing on Portland Police and the Portland Police Bureau, the crossover was when the new resolution was passed and the Portland Police then became partners with the FBI in this terrorism case. Is that where you got involved?
Our organization discovered the nexus between the Portland Police Bureau and the Joint Terrorism Task Force in November of 2000. So it was almost a year before 9/11 happened. And we helped organize community opposition to that, to the point where shortly after 9/11, when the city council was supposed to be voting to re-engage for another year's contract with the FBI, the council chambers were packed with people opposed to it, even though 9/11 had just happened, because they realized that the history of the FBI is not progressive. So when the incident happened, and I had watched the Portland police jump in and out of traffic with barricades, helping to make sure there was a parking space for this van near the square.
Wow.
Thanks to the Portland police. We also are encouraging, I mean, this is going to be a three-week-long trial, a historic trial, and the eyes of the nation are going to be upon us. And it's very important for the community to show up on a daily basis as possible. And if you personally, whoever's listening, can't go every day, that's okay. Just pick a day, a couple of days that you can go. Just make sure there's some kind of presence and try to encourage others that you know to do that as well. So as long as there's somebody from the community there every day, I think that would be very important to show that not everybody thinks that this confused teenager was a threat to our community.
Dan Handelman also said it's unlikely anybody other than media or family will be allowed in the main courtroom. Other people interested in viewing the trial, which begins this Thursday, will have to watch the trial from an overflow room. Buttons expressing political opinions can only be worn in the overflow room and not in the courtroom itself.
Washington County pays the highest wages in the state and the country. KBOO's Don Merrill talked with Jonathan Schleter, the government relations manager for Washington County, to find out why.
Tell me a little bit about Washington County. So how is it that Washington County pays some of the highest wages from a county in the country?
Well, it has an increasingly diverse economy with new employers in different sectors moving here, and it has become a very diverse community. We are very fortunate to have high-tech manufacturing as well as pharmaceutical, sportswear and apparel, healthcare, banking, insurance and finance, all sectors of the economy.
Speaking of sectors, are there any sectors that Washington County considers underrepresented, they would like to put more emphasis on?
No, I don't know that we can immediately say that. One thing we are very proud of is that Washington County is home to about one quarter of all the manufacturing that's done in the state of Oregon. Oregon has always been a manufacturing state. We've always shipped products all over the world. But Washington County, because of this diversity, is now able to claim over 45,000 jobs in the manufacturing sector.
Some of the other counties that were surveyed, you know, aren't lightweights. I mean, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, but yet Washington County. And in fact, I think we had talked a little earlier, and you had said that Washington County is known as the engine of Oregon.
We call Washington County the economic engine of the state of Oregon because this is the fastest growing county in the state. One in four new residents to the state of Oregon move and settle into Washington County. That is not a new trend. That is a continuation of historic trends, but both in aggregate terms and in percentage terms, that means that Washington County is growing faster than 35 other Oregon counties. With that, we are also gaining one in five jobs created in the state of Oregon in the past year. And the Labor Department reports 2.5% growth in the past year. A lot of that is only recovering the jobs that were lost in the recent economic recession, but many of them are new jobs as well. And they tend to be higher paying and higher benefit jobs, the traded sector jobs that are most coveted in many communities in the state and in the country. We are investing in transportation. Washington County has a transportation investment program that we call our Major Street Transportation Improvement Plan, where the county residents have agreed to tax themselves to pay for the roads and transportation infrastructure that they need. But we also have a unified, coordinated water treatment system, the Clean Water Services, and our water treatment systems to supply the vital water and utilities that serve these companies and these communities.
So one other thing I wanted to ask you. So what was it about Washington County? What is it about Washington County that makes people want to commute from 12 other counties around the state to you? I mean, is it geography? Is it natural resource? I mean, what is it?
A lot of the diversity and opportunities available here. These are the companies that are actively expanding and investing in Oregon. Right now, Washington County is home to $6 billion of private sector investment. That includes Intel's new fab plant, the D1X and the D1X Plus 2 expansions on the Ronald Acres campus. It includes TriQuint Semiconductor. Kaiser Permanente is building the first hospital to be built in Washington County in 50 years.
Right, I understand that. I mean, I understand that there are a lot of corporations that are based in Washington County right now. But I'm just curious. I mean, did the county offer tax breaks or land cost breaks? I mean, what was it that drew those companies there?
There have been incentives to some of the larger companies and some of the larger investments there under the Strategic Investment Program. Intel and Genentech have been among the beneficiaries of that program. Yes. Others are only here because the growing population provides them the customer base and service territory that they need to be prosperous.
That was Jonathan Schleter, Government Relations for Washington County, talking to KBOO's Don Merrill about the recent report saying the county pays the highest wages in the state and the nation.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud features author Chris Deliani discussing his book, You Are Here, which is about an aspiring painter making his way through life and relations with his male love interests. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is 100% chance of rain, with a high of 44 degrees.
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The ivory tower of academia has become overshadowed by a new edifice on campus that is reaching ridiculous heights, the Tower of Mammon. As public universities have been driven by budget-whacking lawmakers to seek ever more private funding, what were once centers of free thinking are increasingly dominated by corporate sales gimmicks. A lot of schools are taking a much more corporate approach, exulted a PR executive who works with top administrators, marveling that, quote, a CMO didn't even exist on most campuses 10 years ago. A what? A chief marketing officer. Marketing what? As explained by the CMO of the University of California system, the changing funding landscape requires universities to sell themselves to moneyed elites, which means academic institutions must rework what he calls their visual identities. Forget intellectual pursuits. We're talking about corporate branding, complete with the kind of ridiculous come-ons that hawkers of consumer products often barf up. Iowa's Drake University, for example, rebranded itself a couple of years ago with the slogan, Drake Plus. That was intended to sell students and donors alike on the clever equation that Drake plus you would equal remarkable results, even excellence. This might have been just an inane but innocuous bit of PR puffery, except that the school's marketing geniuses chose to reach for PR artistry, substituting the letter D to refer to Drake. Yes, that meant that the official brand they created to characterize their institution of higher learning was D+. Not exactly a standard of academic excellence. This is Jim Hightower saying, educational achievement is not a product of marketers, but of, well, of educators. A school with plenty of good teachers will sell itself. So here's a concept. Fire the CMO and hire a couple more teachers.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
TriMet General Manager Neil McFarlane has called for an internal audit of TriMet's operators' overall schedules aimed at keeping fatigued drivers from operating vehicles. On Sunday, an Oregonian article about TriMet exposed shortcomings regarding schedule policies. The agency allows drivers to work almost 22 hours a day, often only sleeping for a brief 3 hours between shifts. These long working hours cause operators to lose judgment and the ability to do their job safely. Most drivers who choose to work long hours are trying to rack up overtime pay, grabbing shifts every chance they get. The audit would require stricter oversight of employee working hours. TriMet drivers are not subject to state and federal laws governing work hours. Yesterday, Zoe White spoke with Bruce Hansen, the president of the Local 757 Transit Workers Union.
The short question is, everyone's saying that employees for TriMet are being overworked. To what extent are they being overworked?
Well, I think the impression out there is that employees work long shifts, long hours, and that is the claim.
What percentage of TriMet operators are working more than 10 hours per shift a week? One of the statistics in the Oregonian was that the average shift of a TriMet operator was 9.2 hours. What percentage of people are working more than 10 hours a shift?
I wouldn't know the exact percentage. That would change on a daily basis.
Okay. Now, a person who was operating a Yellow Line train, he nodded off when he was behind the wheel of the light rail 417. He had begun working that day at 3:45 in the morning. Is it up to the employee whether or not they design their hours or whether or not it's management putting them to work for excessive amounts of hours?
Well, I think it's always up to the operator to know their limits and when to call if they're fatigued. They need to call that as an issue, and they need to mark off.
Now,
that would be their decision.
How much say does a TriMet operator have when it comes to designing their hours and how many hours, and would TriMet sign a person up deliberately? This is a 16-hour shift. You're supposed to work a 20-hour or 22-hour shift. And if so, does the TriMet employee have recourse if they can't handle it without fearing reprisal?
Yeah, we have what we call a 12-hour rule, meaning it work over 12 hours, you can't be penalized for declining it.
TriMet released a statement saying that it's a rare occurrence that a person works more than 12 hours a shift. Are you generally in agreement with this statement?
Working 12 hours or on the clock for 12 hours, I guess, would be my clarification. I would need to understand that. I guess my explanation to that is we, as operators, you sit there on report and standby waiting for a piece of work to go over, which you're being paid for, but you're not actually driving your bus or a vehicle.
TriMet's statement was, "Our operators are trained professionals, and safety is a core value that our riders can trust. We have safety measures in place if operators are fatigued. We have a few bus operators that choose to work a lot of overtime, and at times with just a few hours off, but this is a rare occurrence." To what extent do you agree, or does the union agree with that statement, if the union agrees with that statement?
Well, I think we could agree to the aspect that it probably is a rare occurrence where they double back, maybe based on their own schedule.
Is TriMet renegotiating its contract with the union at this time?
We have contract negotiations. We're waiting for a Multnomah County judge to render a decision under public meetings law.
Okay, I can respect the fact that you don't want to reveal all the details
sure.
At this point in time. Bruce Hansen, everyone, I do want to thank you for coming on the show.
All right.
This is 90.7 FM KBOO News in Portland, Oregon.
And that was KBOO's Zoe White speaking with Bruce Hansen of Transit Workers Local Union 757.
Last night, 160 residents of Hillsboro attended a public meeting introducing a proposed Walmart development in the western Portland suburb. The site for the proposed store is a 250-square-foot parcel connected to Southwest Baseline Road and Northwest Cornelius Pass Road. 10 years ago, a 140,000-square-foot Walmart supercenter was proposed at the same location, but the proposal was shot down by the Hillsborough Planning Commission after months of public opposition. The current proposal includes a 50,000-square-foot neighborhood store, two additional retail buildings, and a 242-unit apartment complex that will be north of the location. 2 years ago, Walmart announced a plan to construct 17 stores in the Portland area and have faced strong opposition to this plan. Meanwhile, the retail giant was listed yesterday as a defendant in a class action wage theft lawsuit. KBOO's Rebecca Ney has more.
A year and a half ago, several warehouse workers in Southern California filed a lawsuit against three Walmart subcontractors, accusing them of wage theft. Supporting the plaintiffs in the lawsuit is Warehouse Workers United, or WWU. The group is a non-unionized organization that advocates for warehouse workers. Here is WWU spokesperson Elizabeth Brennan.
This lawsuit is primarily focused on wage and hour violations, which means that the workers were not paid minimum wage. In California, that's $8 an hour, and workers are owed overtime when they work more than 8 hours a day. And we have found a very well documented that workers were paid on a piece rate system that amounted to less than minimum wage, and that frequently they would be missing large amounts from their paychecks, and if they complained, they would risk losing their jobs. So they filed the class action lawsuit that's been working its way through the courts, and then at the end of November, we determined that Walmart is ultimately responsible. They're at the top of the food chain, and that we should add them as a defendant in the lawsuit. So yesterday, the judge issued a preliminary order that will allow Walmart to be sued.
That tentative ruling comes from District Court Judge Christina Snyder. Walmart contends that it is not responsible for the actions of its subcontractors. According to Brennan, Walmart's involvement is significant.
They don't actually run the warehouse. They contracted out to a logistics firm called Schneider Logistics. And Schneider then contracts out to two temporary staffing agencies that the warehouse workers actually work for. We didn't know until we got into deposing the people who work at the warehouse and interviewing everybody just how involved Walmart was with the day-to-day operations at the warehouse.
While yesterday's ruling is tentative, Brennan discusses its significance.
We're still waiting for the official ruling. But tentatively, the federal court judge in Los Angeles ruled in favor of the workers, which is significant because it means that Walmart could be held responsible for the massive violations in this warehouse, which could have a ripple effect in other warehouses and also for other retailers where there might be similar illegal practices.
2 years ago, the retail giant announced plans to construct as many as 17 stores in the Portland metro area, with the proposed Hillsborough location as one of them. I asked Elizabeth Brennan to talk about the impact a Walmart store would have on the neighborhood and its workers.
We take the position that, if they want to expand, they need to treat workers with respect. They need to consider their effect on workers across their entire supply chain. So from the factories overseas that make their goods to the warehouse workers who move their goods domestically. And we just don't see that. And for the most part, the stores have been met with a lot of opposition here, too, because people don't like what Walmart stands for.
I've been speaking with Warehouse Workers United spokesperson Elizabeth Brennan. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
Disgraced insurance giant American International Group, or AIG, plans to announce tomorrow whether it will join a lawsuit against the U.S. government for bailing them out in September of 2008. AIG has received a total of more than $182 billion between the original loan and subsequent tax breaks. AIG's consideration of the lawsuit comes even as they are running a Thank You America ad campaign, which points out that the company has paid back the bailout funds and even made a $22 billion profit for taxpayers. The company says that it is considering joining the lawsuit out of an obligation to its shareholders, many of whom allege that the government's takeover of the company during the bailout violated their rights. Some cite the Fifth Amendment prohibition against the taking of private property for public use without just compensation. Many officials are outraged, including consumer advocate and Massachusetts Senator-elect Elizabeth Warren, who said the company should not, quote, bite the hand that fed them for helping them out in a time of crisis.
Oregon Representative Greg Walden, the state's only Republican representative, has offered legislation that would stop the U.S. Mint from producing platinum $1 trillion coins. He said that the production of these coins is, quote, dangerous and absurd, unquote, and that it would not be helpful in moving away from the debt ceiling. The legislative proposal allowing the coins was proposed as a way for the government to pay its dues without going into more debt and instead pulling money from the Federal Reserve. Although some economists have stated that this could create hyperinflation of the U.S. economy, U.S. Treasury officials argue that minting these coins would have little to no effect on inflation. The government intends to offset any inflationary impact by selling some of the trillions in Treasury securities it already owns. The production of platinum coins, as opposed to gold, silver, and bronze, does not have any laws restricting the amount the government can produce and distribute into circulation. The coins would be deposited into the Federal Reserve. Representative Walden has stated that he wants D.C. to go back to the more traditional path of spending cuts.
Today, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced plans to require corporations to publicly disclose their political spending. This move came after a pressure campaign by citizens' rights group Common Cause. Currently, all other groups, including associations, unions, and individuals, are required to disclose their political campaign contributions. Only corporations are exempt from disclosure. Corporate funds are frequently tunneled through third-party groups, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which refuse to disclose the underlying donors who provide the financial resources for their political activities. The Chamber of Commerce was the single largest outside spender in the 2010 elections and spent more than $36 million on the 2012 elections. The new rule by the SEC will increase the transparency of political spending by corporations. It will not, however, overturn the 2010 Supreme Court decision known as Citizens United, which has allowed corporations to spend unlimited amounts on political campaigns.
This spring, Disney Parks will introduce a new element to the Disney vacation experience, wristbands equipped with radio frequency identification, or RFID technology. Called Magic Bands, the devices will contain visitors' personal information, including